Of the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order in the Oregon State Legislature. The date is January 29th, 2007. Today we'll be having public hearing on an array of bills around the construction industry and the Construction Contractors Board specifically. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2107. And Steve, would you give us the preview of this House bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2107 requires construction contractors to notify the Construction Contractors Board of judgments or arbitration awards against contractors and creates exemptions.
And so we will have up the Construction Contractors Board, Craig Smith. If you just want to tell us a little bit about this bill and why.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair Halvey and members of the committee. My name is Craig Smith. I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. And today, while Mr. Boyd has my back and will be here to answer technical questions, I'm joined on my left by Tom Scar. Tom is a construction contractor licensed by the board for going on nearly 30 years. Tom is currently the chair of the Construction Contractors Board and serves in leadership capacity with the Oregon Home Builders. This is a...
Just a moment, Craig. You know, I'm looking at this, and I think I'm going to open the public hearing on 2108, 2110, and 2120 along with 2107. So we can just sort of move through your presentation from one to the next.
Wonderful. Appreciate that, sir. 2107 is an answer to a problem that we've had having to do with contractor construction debt. And as you probably are aware, the Construction Contractors Board is a little bit unique of the other licensing boards in the sense that we do have a dispute resolution component with our agency. And that is you think of it kind of as a civil court system. The best part of it is the fact that when a complaint is filed and homeowners can file complaints, other contractors can file complaints, even employees can file complaints against contractors suggesting that the contractor has done something wrong, failed to pay a debt, or perform negligent work. We go out and try to settle those matters. And full 50% of the time, we're able to, before things go to a court, before things go to a hearing, we're able to get matters settled at a very low cost to both parties, and we're very proud of that intervention. We think it's a great benefit. But it doesn't happen every time. From time to time, we end up with matters that have to go to hearing, and when those matters are heard, sometimes the contractor loses and is obligated to pay that debt. If they don't pay it, that's adjudicated against the surety bond. For a general contractor, that's $15,000. So that works pretty well. And you see some stats on the front of this page that show the number of complaints filed this year just by consumers against against residential contractors. The amount of damages in excess of the settlements that we have adjudicated against those contractors. And you can see that's in excess of $3 million. That's just what we do here at CCB in one fiscal year. The amount paid by contractors was almost $400,000. Surety companies paid about a third, about $1 million, and that left unpaid almost $2 million last fiscal year. Now, that's just CCB. In many cases, disputes are handled by the court system or through private arbitration, which is great because we don't have all the resources in the world. We can't do it all. It also is good for people who prefer that. They have a more complicated dispute or they prefer to have private arbitration resolve the matters. From time to time, however, those parties who prevail against a contractor are unaware that the CCB has the authority to discipline the contractor by taking its license away if that debt that an arbitrator or a judge has ordered to be paid. We don't know how much is out there. We do know that from time to time we have claimants who discover us and send us a copy of those judgments. And when we do get a copy of the judgment, if it's ripe, if it's final, all the appeals are done, then we'll start a proceeding to take that contractor's license away if the debt doesn't get paid. And we think that's appropriate. That helps hold contractors accountable. I think that's what you want. That's what the law certainly allows us to do. What this bill would do is it would require contractors, if they lose in arbitration or they lose in a court proceeding and they don't pay the debt within 30 days, they have an obligation to tell the CCB. Now, I don't hold my breath that if that happens and it's a contractor that's in a lot of trouble, sometimes that won't happen. But the law would require that that be the case. And if we found out that a contractor hadn't paid, we'd start the action to suspend the contractor's license. It would take several months at this point, or the contractor would be adversely affected. But it would, again, I think, help hold those contractors accountable for those unpaid debts. And we believe there is a number of those. I think that summarizes what the bill would do. I'd be open for questions, and I don't know if Tom has anything he wants to add before we go to that.
Just would answer questions if anyone has any.
And did he state his name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. My name is Tom Scar. Do you want an address?
No. Whatever group you're representing.
Tom Scar, and the chair of the Construction Contractors Board.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee. Representative Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just one. The requirement that the contractor inform you in 30 days, is there a difference in the outcome than you finding out in 30 days on your own? What's the incentive for that contractor to actually do that?
Yeah, very good question. I hear the question as if this were law and if the contractor failed to notify you, what kind of penalty might the contractor have? In other words, what's the incentive for the contractor to comply with the law?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good question. Haven't thought that far. Oregon law, the contractor's law, does allow for any breach of this statute to have a civil penalty of up to $5,000. So in the event the Assembly made this Oregon law, failure of a contractor to notify CCB of such a debt that remains unpaid for greater than 30 days could be subject of a civil penalty up to $5,000. Currently, similar matters have penalties of between $5,000 and $1,000 in our penalty matrix. I would imagine such a situation like this, in the first couple of years, we probably would not aggressively enforce that law, but would look to warn contractors if we find out, because something like this would be a change in an obligation the contractor has. But after a couple of years, I imagine we'd have a fair penalty, probably somewhere between $5,000 and $1,000.
Follow up, Representative Brown.
Thank you. So if I'm a contractor, and it's 30 days since I've had a judgment against me, and I owe a consumer some money, and I contact you, do you at that time start proceedings to take my license away?
Yeah.
And so if you don't hear from me, it'll be a while before you hear about it, before you start the proceedings to take my license away. It just seems like this is a law without a penalty.
Chair Hulvey, Representative Riley, I can appreciate that. Today, this is one of the complaints we have. Today, there is no obligation on the part of the contractor to tell us, and we thought that was at least a place to start. And as I say, the law does allow for a penalty up to $5,000.
Any other questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, when you say if we found out without them telling us, what normally would be your avenues for finding out?
Okay. Chair Hulvey, Representative Gilliam, usually is the unpaid party, the homeowner. In many cases, we've had other businesses, other licensed contractors who have sued. They've sued each other. They didn't get paid, and we get a copy of the judgment. And you know, because they're aware of the CCB, and they've sent us a copy of the judgment, and then we would start suspension proceedings. And one thing that might be important to know is that currently in administrative law, in order to suspend a license, it takes several months, maybe as much as 6 months, including hearings before administrative law judge, as well as an appeal to the contractors board itself, and appeals can go all the way up to the Court of Appeals. And so it's not as if the board would be able to immediately suspend a contractor's license for this unpaid debt.
Quick follow-up to that?
Follow-up, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if somebody is going, you know, to the trouble of the legal proceedings against a contractor, it seems to me, wouldn't it be rare if they would not tell you there's been a judgment? I mean, wouldn't that be part of their case against their contractor?
Right. Chair Hovey and Representative Gilliam, we believe, based upon several surveys we've done, we have a market share of about 30%, meaning that about 30% of the population know about CCB. So there's 70% that could be dealing with a contractor not even aware that CCB could help them with this, what essence amounts to a collection issue.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, ma'am.
I have a question about what you're trying to get at with this bill, and I think it just has to do with the financial aspect if the contractor has a judgment owing. But I wonder if you could tell me, is there some other mechanism, and I'm not familiar with everything that you do, for you to determine when a contractor is doing negligent or improper work that relates to construction? Because under this bill, you could have a contractor who has multiple judgments against him or her, but you don't know about them because they've already paid them and they don't have to tell you.
Right.
So is there some other way that you get that information?
Right.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey and Representative Bonamici, that's a fair question, and I've seen bills before the Senate that would treat other contracting agencies differently, and it would be broader. In other words, that their licensees would be required to notify the licensing agency regardless of whether they prevailed or not or paid the debt or not. This is scaled back a little bit from that. I think the logic here was that if the contractor paid its debt, perhaps it's not the state's business. I think that's the salient point. The negligent and improper work issue, those are the grounds that CCB currently has to process a dispute against a contractor's license, so that if I'm your contractor and I do crummy work, you'd file a claim with CCB alleging either I breached the contract by not completing it or put a bad roof on the house, did it poorly. And we'd process that. Because we have the ability to process those types of matters, we thought that it would be a parallel form of regulation to require contractors to tell us if they lost in court about similar circumstances. Again, we are concerned that there is a substantial amount of debt out there that we are not aware of.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative.
Mr. Smith. My question would be if this bill were to pass, I don't know if you have it already in your performance measures when you go before Ways and Means, but I think this body would be interested in knowing how effective it were to be. I mean, I think Representative Riley hit the nail on the head, get it? I get pun intended, of course. I think a lot of people are just going to take their chances. I would think that's going to happen. But is there already a way for you to keep track of this, and will you, and are you able to do that? Because I think we would want to know if this was effective at all.
Sure. Chair Holby and Representative Galizio, I think it's a fair criticism. I think that in many cases, the requirements that you put on licensees where we work and other industries, you have a certain amount of voluntary compliance. And if people don't comply, you got some problems. Now, granted, we've got a $5,000 civil penalty authority, but we're not going to see all those cases. In many cases, however, because of the fear of, another $5,000 or another penalty on top of the fact that you didn't pay your original debt, I think pretty soon people start to would recognize that it doesn't pay not to tell the agency. I think this one, frankly, we would be all right with in terms of getting fairly good voluntary compliance. But, your question of could you monitor this and let you know how many times people are letting the agency know that there was an unpaid court judgment? Absolutely. We'd be happy to do that, and we could.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holden, and thank you for being here, Craig and Tom. I don't see a time period for in which the construction contractors, that's almost a tongue twister, have to furnish you with this document. The only thing you refer to in time is if they haven't paid it in 30 days. So within getting this judgment, is it within 10 days, or which would probably be a good timeline?
I'm reading from the bill. You may have found a flaw.
Well, I'm not looking for a flaw. I'm just trying to make this realistic, if it is.
Sure.
To be.
Let me, Chair Holby and Representative Nelson, I'm looking at line 16 of the bill. It reads, the contractor pay the damages, other amounts payable to the contractor under the judgment of the award, no later than 30 days after recording of the judgment, which doesn't really get to your question. Probably would have to put that in the form of some rule. If we did have rulemaking authority, and I believe we would, I would testify to you today that we would look at a reasonable period of time, probably 30 to 60 days, by which the contractor would notify the contractor's board.
Thank you, Chair.
Well, good point. Any other questions? Craig, I have one. This will probably generate more testimony later, but I noticed this bill's addressing generally construction, but in a couple of paragraphs it's just related to residential structures, and I guess my question is, if you had a bad player in the commercial industry, wouldn't you want to have the same sort of guidelines for them?
Right. Good point. Chair Holby, it's a good point. This bill is just for residential contractors. It's not that residential contractors have more or less problems than commercial contractors. I think they're both 99%. They do great work. The commercial industry, and you have an expert in the room here that could testify better than I, but let me just say that the commercial industry has different mechanisms. They don't appear to have the need to have this kind of law. We received at the task force, as well as in front of the Construction Contractors Board, significant amount of testimony from consumers of residential services that there were needs in this arena. We received no similar testimony from individuals in the commercial sector. So this is the reason why we aimed it towards the residential field.
Follow up?
You started it, Chair. Yeah. No, seriously.
Well, you finish it for a minute.
Briefly, can you just give us the top three reasons why almost $2 million were not paid?
Sure.
Just quickly three. We don't have to go into the...
Chair Holby and Representative Nelson.
Judgment.
The major reason contractors don't pay these debts is they go out of business. And your question might be, well, why do they do that, Craig? And I guess the bottom line is that they fail for one reason or another. I've seen contractors underbid. I've seen contractors have a personal family emergency, divorces, medical problems. I've seen contractors who have problems with their partners, and the partners cause a fallout that ends up in a bankruptcy. Most of these situations are contractors who either will bankrupt those debts, or they'll move out of state, because of course we'll take the licenses away from contractors who don't pay those debts. So there's a lot of reasons, and we've testified in prior years that the major reason is that the contractors don't pay their debts when they get into financial difficulty as a result of not running their business well. And that's the reason why we try to train in business competency, because that's where I think most of the problems reside.
Further questions? Craig, just to follow up on Representative Nelson's concern about the time frame that doesn't seem to be identified in the bill, and I don't really see, surely the CCB has the ability to make that happen by rule, but do you think that this is something that we should codify in this particular statute and make it much more clear about that time frame that seems to be missing?
Representative Holby, if you'd move the bill, I think it'd be a great idea to put that in there. If we could get if that would satisfy the committee, we would be very happy if you would put a reasonable amount of time in there. And we'd be happy to suggest something to you if you wanted that. And I think anywhere between 30 and 90 days would be reasonable.
Okay, we'll take that under advisement. Shall we move on to 2108?
Do you want a staff summary, Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah. Steve, would you give us a brief overview?
It looks like it will be pretty brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2108 requires construction contractor or agent to notify Construction Contractors Board within 30 days of filing for bankruptcy. Makes the violation subject to a civil penalty not to exceed $5,000.
And Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board.
Thank you, Chair Holby. And I would guess we don't need to re-identify ourselves for the record as one continuous record.
Yeah, you're still under the same public hearing, so you're good to go.
All right, thank you, sir.
I just did that for the benefit of any listeners out there, or viewers, perhaps.
Sure.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, we talked a little bit. I think this actually is good that we're able to look at the previous problem first, because unpaid court judgments and arbitration awards often do result in bankruptcy filings. And bankruptcy filings, I need to tell you, are perhaps the most painful thing, not only for contractors, and they are painful for the contractors and their families. Those of us who have had to file bankruptcies suffer as a result to a degree. But it is the folks that they've done business with that suffer perhaps more. And during the course of the last 12 months, and indeed the last several years, we've heard repeated stories from consumers where contractors have filed bankruptcy and left a lot of money on the table and started over again. And in some cases, harmed more individuals. This is a bill that is not dissimilar from the first one we looked at, which would require contractors to tell us if indeed they filed for protection under the bankruptcy laws. In some cases, and I might even say most that I'm aware of, contractors that have formulated under the as a corporation or as an LLC, a limited liability company, in many cases, those contractors, when they do get into trouble, they just let the business go. And they don't even file bankruptcy because you have these sideboards on the outside of business that protect the owners from those debts. And it's the owners and the members of the LLCs then that file bankruptcy because quite often those debts have been secured by the owners of the business. For purposes of material dealers, in some cases the bonds, so that when when those businesses lose in court and the creditors can't go after the business themselves, they go after the individuals. So the individuals often file bankruptcy. We have one contractor who, when I last checked, and I think this was the subject of this in the newspaper here a year ago, who was a licensed contractor who had discharged $860,000 of construction debt. A licensed contractor. That's hard. That's hard for me to accept that that's what we do, but that's what we did. And I can tell you that we display that information on our website. We don't do it, obviously, as any kind of a punishment, but we think that people have a right to know if they're going to deal with a contractor who has lost $860,000 that's been adjudicated by CCB and it's not paid, it's discharged in bankruptcy, people have a right to know that. Again, we're not privy to all of those discharged debts. Now, an insurance company probably is because they're more sophisticated. They're able to look at the records. Credit card companies, other creditors, but a consumer who's seeking to buy a $500,000 home from a contractor who's in financial difficulties may not look to go any further than the CCB records. And indeed, I've never met a consumer that was as sophisticated as an insurance company or a credit card company or other major supplier. Instead, they go to CCB records. And if they're licensed, bonded, and insured, that means something to those people. And the truth of the matter is that the bond is not as high as it could be to protect people. The insurance is probably not going to protect them if all things go bad. And so a contractor who's in financial difficulties, and if we're not telling people about that, well, I think that's a pretty tough shake for consumers. And so this was an idea, and it's a tough one a little bit for us because, you know, bankruptcy is a right. You have a right to file bankruptcy. And there are a lot of laws that go along with that that allow for creditors not to go after people if they file for those protections. So the question does come up, how much information should something like the State of Oregon Licensing Board, what should they have on their website regarding bankruptcy? And we're bringing this to you. This is clearly a policy decision, whether or not you think that these licensees should tell the license board that they're going through this very difficult time, and go one step further and say, not only should the licensee, in many cases an LLC or a corporation, tell the board, but corporate officers should tell the board as well. We bring it to you because of the stories we've heard in the past and the fact that currently it's not required by law. I should tell you that if people told us about it, we probably would strongly consider putting that information on the website. And if we put it on the website, that probably would affect that contractor's ability in the marketplace, and it wouldn't affect it in a positive way. But as you probably know, the Construction Contractors Board is predominantly construction contractors. Mr. Scar is one. This was a tough sell, frankly, to my board, but they bought it, and we're bringing it to you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Smith. How long will the CCB keep the information? For example, if an individual officer files bankruptcy after the effective date, assuming this would pass, and then 10 years from now or 15 years from now, will it still be on the record? Or is there a time frame for keeping?
And Chair Holvey and Representative Bonamici, currently CCB information is listed on the website per contractor for 7 years. After 7 years, it goes off. And again, this is a situation where we haven't addressed that in the bill. We think that if you choose to give this authority to the board, that we'd have some pretty tough hearings about this, because you can see clearly there's two sides to this, and a person shouldn't be tarred with this information forever. We would probably set it by rule. In my mind, I was thinking somewhere between 3 and 7 years.
Further questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. first of all, Tom, how do the contractors feel about this board? Do you have a warm and fuzzy relationship?
By and large, yes. Yes, the board exists to serve contractors and to provide licensing services and education and things of that nature for the construction contracting community, and also to provide consumer protection. But in my experience anyway, in my relationships both with two constituency groups, one's the Oregon Home Builders Association, the other one's the Metropolitan Portland Home Builders Association, we have I would call it an amicable relationship, certainly not adversarial.
So a follow-up, please.
Follow-up, please.
So when you all are, if this is the Construction Contractors Board organization, when y'all are thinking of these bills, do you go over these with them first?
There is discussion, certainly, amongst the peer groups, yes. In the case of these particular bills, there wasn't a lot of discussion at the local level or even, for that matter, at the state level. There's not been a lot of controversy about these couple of bills in particular. That's not to say that there aren't things proposed in front of the board occasionally that are controversial. These are not. As an industry, we are ill-served by people doing bad things to consumers as well. It's a bad mark on all of us and on all of our companies and our reputations. And so I think it would be fair to say that as an industry, we're supportive of the idea of making people accountable and requiring that people be accountable for their bad debts and when they file bankruptcy, for having that information be public record and be readily available to consumers so that they're at least informed. So that never again does Craig get a call someday from some consumer who's been hurt by somebody who filed bankruptcy a couple of years ago, went into business under a new name, and caused that consumer harm as well. And then we have to answer the question, well, how come that information wasn't disclosed on the website?
I can't believe you said that, because I was just thinking, what's to stop me from filing bankruptcy today as Donna Nelson LLC and tomorrow being Nelson Contractors? I've filed bankruptcy today. Tomorrow I'm back in business. And what benefit is it to say you're going to get a $5,000 fine? I'm already broke, you know, and all these subcontractors are going to come before you, I think, if I ask counsel. They're going to come before you in payment, ultimately, anyway. Would it be better that these people have... lose a privilege for a month or 30 days or something, because I can see a lot of a lot of problems coming out of this, of starting a new business, and I don't believe anything in here says you can't do that.
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, it's absolutely true that kind of scenario does play out. I can tell you that we struggle with the bankruptcy law. Again, it's interesting because of it is complex, and there are experts that we deal with on it. In the past, we did have a statutory solution that would prevent me from owning a licensed corporation or LLC, running it into the ground, filing bankruptcy, and then starting a new business. We had a law, 701.100. But I can tell you that law was recently tested in the United States Bankruptcy Court, and the state of Oregon lost.
Yes.
And so we will be giving licenses to people who, new licenses to people who, that occurred to.
Well, just to
follow up,
you know, my goodness, we just keep, you know, weaving a web. I think, because here we are on this other issue where we don't want our credit rating to affect our insurance premiums. Now we're doing that very thing, you know, the insurance companies, many of them are sureties also. And do you have something? I mean, some kind of rating for these contractors that, you know, I mean, would it be possible that I could contract with one that's had three bankruptcies in the last 10 years, or whatever you can do, 7 years?
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, yes, it is possible for that to occur. We don't rate the contractors. The contractor's ability to get a surety bond is affected by that type of behavior, and in some cases the fact that they can't get a surety bond because of bad credit or bad bankruptcy issues can keep them out of licensure.
Comment? Chair Holby, Representative Nelson. One of the other things as a board we can do with somebody who has that kind of history is rather deny them a license altogether. We can increase the requirement for bond, and we do that.
Oh.
And in so doing, we have the statutory authority presently to require up to 5 times the normal bond, which would be a $75,000 bond. That effectively probably would keep a fair number of them out of the business.
Indeed. Excuse me.
Follow up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you all still feel that we ought to have a civil penalty of $5,000? I mean, you're likely not to get it forever.
Right.
So doing this seems more prudent.
Well, Chair Holder, Representative Nelson, we probably should do both. And you're probably right. We probably won't get it. But it's further nail in the coffin, I guess, if you will. And if we assess fines, then that further gives us a right against the old company, I guess, if you will, permanent suspension of license and teller if it's paid. I guess the answer to the question is yes, we should do both.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little follow-up on Representative Nelson's. If a company is reported and it goes into bankruptcy and lets you know, and then they go out of business as CR Enterprises and go back into business as Chuck Riley Enterprises, will Chuck Riley Enterprises be on your website as having had a bankruptcy?
Good point.
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, what we have envisioned is obviously just the requirement that Mr. Riley, I would presume, is the one that filed the bankruptcy. He would have an obligation to tell the agency. In the case of the first business, that's where it would probably show. If, in fact, it was a personal bankruptcy and Mr. Riley had a second business and was not more than 7 years later, it's quite possible that the agency would choose to list that against that new license as well. But as we were discussing out in the hall, this is certainly an item. This bill only requires the information to be given. We would need to have some pretty heated, probably, administrative rule hearings in which the public would testify both on the one hand having more information, and in some cases others might suggest less information out on the web. I can tell you that's been a bone of contention for the last 20 years, how much information we put on the web and how we do it. We're in a position right now where we have an awful lot of information on that website. We get a lot of comments about it now that are very favorable, but this is a sensitive issue, and I think we'd have to struggle with what to put out on the web in this case.
Follow up, please. Thank you. And I wish we had actually reversed the order of these, because coming up is our information notice, and I think that ties a lot of this together, and people who currently don't even know that there is such a thing as a CCB and a website to look at, after this goes into effect, at least should know.
Sure.
And that will make a huge difference, I think, if the information's there. If the information isn't there, it makes no difference at all.
Right.
Good point. Further questions? Representative Nelson?
I'm sorry. It just seems I'm kind of leaning Chuck's way, you know. our order would have. Of course, I'm on his committee with him. But I'm very worried about the subcontractors. So I guess I want to say, let me just ask you. I'm running the business. Heaven help construction. I'm so technical. But anyway. So I'm running a business. I take a bankruptcy. Okay. This project needs to go on. I've already committed. Okay. So there's nothing in here that should halt a construction project being done by others?
Yeah. Chair Hovey and Representative Nelson, yes, this bill would not create another reason to stop the construction or to take the license away, subject to the contractor properly complying with the law and telling the agency that it filed bankruptcy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Seeing no further questions, I'll just comment that Representative Riley stole my question.
Oh, my word.
I was going to ask the same question of why couldn't we list those that have declared bankruptcy on the web. So, I mean, you can't keep them from getting another license, but you could at least show their history.
I think that's a very good point.
I hope that that's something that the board will consider and discuss at this point.
If they don't, maybe we will.
I didn't say that.
I did.
So, no further questions on that one. Why don't we go ahead and move on in our order of 21, which one's next? 2110. Please read us a brief description, Steve.
Okay. House Bill 2110 requires construction contractor to retain written evidence that the contractor delivered notice to a property owner. Sufficient evidence will be set by rulemaking undertaken by the Construction Contractors Board. Failure to retain written evidence creates presumption notification was not given and gives owner extended time to file claims against the contractor, makes violations of this act subject to civil penalties of no more than $5,000.
Chair Holby, again, Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board. The document we're talking about is on page 8 of the handout, the most recent draft. So you get in your mind's eye what we're talking about. It's a one-page piece of paper that for the last 30-some years, construction contractors have been obligated to provide to their consumers, their customers, on residential structures in one form or another. This started out in 1972-73 to be a requirement by the assembly that builders provide what was then known as a summary of the home building law. But it was designed to make sure that consumers had some idea of the regulations that contractors were obligated to follow and where to go if there was a problem. A few years ago, requirements were made in statute to reduce it to one page. And that's a difficult thing. What do you put on the one page? But what we've tried to do is come up with a document that briefly tells a consumer what to do and where to go to get more information and tells them what to look out for in a form that they'll actually read. Because, you know, we're all familiar with forms in real estate and construction and other laws where, you know, you're sitting there getting ready to sign the documents and it's initial here, initial there, and some of us read those, you know, some of us don't. And we're hoping that this one actually gets read. The problem here is that we've got some pretty good evidence that's not being handed out. Let me just say that up front. And I'm not proud of that because that means I've failed to encourage contractors to do it. So I have to be thinking in my mind, what can I do to encourage contractors to provide this? Of course, we've provided it at no cost. It's on the website. We'll provide written copies. Contractors can put this document on the back of their contracts if they want to. They can also just have it as a free piece of paper. And all I can tell you is that we have two major problems. One is that it's not being given out by contractors, and the other is when it comes time to penalize a contractor, we end up with, I gave it out, and the consumer saying, I didn't get it. And as you well know, in a situation where the state's attempting to discipline a contractor, we must prove that the contractor, in this case, didn't give the document. And any time you're trying to prove a negative, you're in a tough spot as an advocate a judicial proceeding. So in many cases, these matters do not get proven up very well. So we have a couple of solutions for you. First thing is we'd like to have the requirement that the contractors keep a copy of this or some kind of written proof that they gave it. And you can see what we've done on this document is we've actually toyed with the idea of having it perforated at the bottom, and the contractor could tear off the bottom as if it were a receipt, keep that document, just the bottom, and let the consumer keep the top. It could also be a duplicate copy. The idea being that the contractor needs to give that document and then get it signed. The task force is also considering, they're going to bring that to you. If you've read the task force findings at all, they suggest some kind of a writing on the bottom of the consumer notices. Now, the other thing that we think would help with the compliance is to double the length of time it has to file a complaint. And I can tell you that I spoke with a lot of different consumers over the last years, and one of the problems is that they don't know that they only have 12 months. It doesn't make a lot of sense to them. Why can't I file a claim after 13 months or 14 months? What's magic about 12 months? Well, part of it is the fact that, you know, the house changes after 12 months. It's supposed to be for work that was done by the contractor initially. It's not supposed to be maintenance items. So the longer you have as a statute of limitations, the more problematic it is to determine whether or not the problem was a result of bad work or the problem was the homeowner not taking care of the project after the work was done. So there needs to be a statute of limitation, and it's been 1 year for a long time. But what some folks suggest is that if this document, which contains that important information that you only have 1 year to file, if it's not given to the consumer, perhaps you ought to double the length of time that the homeowner has to file a complaint. I know as a contractor in my day, if I had that requirement, I'd give this notice out. I'd give it out because I wouldn't want to double the length of time that my license was in jeopardy to have this dispute solved at the state level. And I think that would motivate contractors to give it. And frankly, I think it's a reasonable complaint or a reasonable penalty to double the length of time to file a complaint if it's not given. The task force recommendations contain a broader solution to you for you to consider. It would recommend you just double it anyway. So this is a solution that's somewhere mid-ground between what I read the task force recommending, which is double the length of time, regardless, and what it is today, which is 1 year only. It would also create a rebuttable presumption in the case that the contractor hasn't been able to prove or haven't maintained the proof of delivery of this document, and that would be important for our proof problem at the hearing level.
Questions? Representative Galizio.
Mr. Schmidt, will this be available for contractors on the website so they can download it?
Chair Holvey and Representative Galizio, yes, it will be.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the difference between the one-year length of time to file a claim and the 10-year liability for builder? What's that?
Okay. Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, you're a little over my head, but let me tell you what I know. With CCB, that's the length of time you have to file at the CCB against the contractor's license, and that's the thing that the contractor's board will adjudicate. The 10 years has to do with what a person can go to court and file in court.
Okay.
Further questions?
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig and Tom, what happens? I'm from Idaho, and my mother wants me to build her house. I'm licensed in Idaho. Do I have reciprocity?
Hmm.
And does this apply to me, or I'm exempt?
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson. It's a great question. Currently, we don't have any reciprocity in Oregon when it comes to CCB law. I think it brings out a good problem, and that is, how are out-of-state contractors supposed to know what Oregon requires?
That's right.
And today we solve that problem by requiring to have a CCB license, and their owner or operator in Oregon has to pass the test. And among the issues that are in the test is what notices need to be given and to whom they have to be given.
I'm just wanting to be sure that I don't have to go through a testing process for an Oregon license because I already have one. Do I have to? I do.
You do.
Well, where is that? Where would I find that information?
I want to make sure I'm following Representative's question, Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson. Did I hear you say that you have a license in Idaho?
Yes, sir.
And
this is actual factual.
Okay. And you'd like to know where in the Oregon law does it require you to have a license in Oregon? That'd be an ORS 701.
Okay. And so then.
Follow up, please.
Thank you. So then, if I'm working in this state, this every one of these things apply to me.
Chair Holvey, Representative.
Okay, go back to Idaho. I've declared bankruptcy in Oregon. I can't hop over the line back. Excuse me a minute to interrupt you. To Idaho and build, you know, my father-in-law's house.
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, for you it would be different. But ordinarily,
it'd be crazy.
You know, ordinarily, frankly, with out-of-state contractors that come into Oregon, and if they have a problem in Oregon, we kind of push them back out of the state. You know, we don't want contractors coming from out of state that don't pay attention to Oregon laws and then cause grief to consumers. And so we do our best to make it difficult for out-of-state contractors who don't obey the law to operate in Oregon.
Further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a pretty user-friendly form here. Is there any opposition? I see some other people in the room. I don't know. Is anybody opposed to the use of this form?
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Bonamici. I know of no opposition, none that's come to me. I think it's fair to say, though, just to dovetail back on to Representative Nelson's issue having to do with what has the agency done with associations and so forth, this stuff has come at us, this session has come at us so fast. We haven't done as much as we would have liked to try to make sure we know who supports and who opposes. But what I can tell you is that we've done all this in sunlight at the board level, at the board level, which is predominantly contractors who belong to trade associations. All I can tell you is we've received no letters nor absolute commitments to oppose this legislation. With that said, I don't have any on the other side either, where I have something in writing from a organization saying that they will support these measures.
Thank you.
Follow up, please.
Thank you. Final question on your my page 8. Your I think this is one. I just want to clue you into having negotiated lots of international contracts. I found out that we need to declare what language they're to be in. So I'm just going to suggest to you that you just establish English and leave it there. That's what's, you know, used in the court system. So you in English, because the translation could be so different if it were done in German or Italian or Spanish or anything else. And, you know, I've been on the bad side of that, so I know what it's like to try to get a 727 back from Panama when the salesman let them translate the contract. Even U.S. Bank couldn't get it back. So I'm just thinking that maybe we ought to say that.
Final comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. As far as the doubling or leaving alone the 1 year, my suggestion would be to leave it at 1 year, but start at the clock when the notice is given.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a good comment.
It is.
Craig, I have just a question. I guess I need a clarification. Unlike House Bill 2107, just to go backwards a minute, House Bill 2108 appears to affect all contractors, not just residential contractors. And it's unclear to me whether 2110 is intended to just address residential contractors. Part of it specifically talks about residential contractors, but part of it talks about contractors in general. So I was wondering if you can clarify that for me.
If Chair Holby, you're speaking to the issue of the lien law, which is pretty complex. This does not change whether or not a residential or commercial contractor is obligated to provide the. Excuse me, I got my notices confused. When it comes to the consumer notice, which is 2110, the subject we're talking about right now, that's residential contractors only. Does that answer your question, sir?
That does. Although I don't know that that was really spelled out very good in the first, in section two of the bill. Because it says to all licensed contractors.
It doesn't. That's a very good one.
So I was just trying to clarify it for that purpose. I'd be speaking in line seven.
Sure. That I believe that's the way the current language is written in statute. But it's a very good point. Given a half a second, I could point you to the place where it says residential only.
Well, on line 15, it calls for on a residential structure. It just doesn't, and then again on line 19, 21, it talks about residential contractors. I just wanted to make sure that if there's something we need to make sure we're clear on, it could be that. But going back to House Bill 2108, now it appears that applies to all contractors, not just residential. Is that correct?
Representative Holy, that has to do with the bankruptcies, and that would be our intent to have it apply to all contractors.
Okay. That clears it up for me, sort of.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, on line 7 of 2110,
mm-hmm.
where it says, the CCB shall prepare and provide at no cost to all licensed contractors.
Yep.
So will you be amending that?
Chair Holby and Representative Nelson, we could amend that. Again, I believe that's the way the current law is written. That it makes some sense if you wanted to just make that. Of course, the subject of the sentence is providing the notice and who do you provide it to, as opposed to who has to deliver it. And this just says that the board has to make this available to all contractors. The pertinent issue is that only contractors having to do with residential construction have to give it out.
But others may give it out if they so desire.
It's true. We'd be happy to amend the statute if you think that would make it clearer.
Probably a good idea.
Follow up.
And I can relate to that from a Veterans Committee where we had the issue of doing something for the National Guard but leaving out the reserves, you know. So we finally learned to put both of them, you know, in each one. And I think you probably need to do that here. But I would think this would be even more important to a commercial customer. I mean, the volume is huge.
Yeah. Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, what I can tell you is it's always been aimed at residential contractors. Again, I think you have someone in the room that's more expert in that line than I. We don't get a lot of complaints from our commercial customers. And I think that's because of the sophistication of those persons, as well as the other means they have to protect their interests, including performance bonds. And for some of you probably are aware of the performance bond, tremendous product to make sure the contractor produces, because it's for that project only. And it gets the job done. If we tried to require that, it wouldn't be a bad idea for residential contractors, but the cost the cost, I think, would raise the cost of residential construction to the point that you don't have the cost doesn't equal the benefit.
Yes, but, and my point was just to try to remain consistent so that this was clear to the construction community, and I think this committee will have a chance to really make that happen as we look at the task force recommendations and consider, since they're overlapping this bill, we may take a look at that at that time, and I'll direct staff to make sure we clear up that little piece. I would be more comfortable making sure that was clear of who we're talking about when we say all licensed contractors in that one section. It is a little bit misleading, perhaps.
Okay.
So, any other further questions of the CCB on 2110? Do you want to finish up for us on 2120 then? As soon as we're done, I opened a hearing on all the bills, and we'll open it up to testimony as soon as the CCB is done. Thank you, Craig. If you can continue,
okay,
that would be great.
All right, very good. Chair Helvey, members of the committee, this is House Bill 2120, and this deals with the important issue, again, of the lien law having to do with the information notice to owner about construction liens. And this document that we're talking about, so again, to get this in your mind's eye, is a two-page document. It's on page 3 and 4 of the handout. Oregon's lien law is somewhat complicated, and what notices need to be handed out are sometimes confused, even by me. So let it be clear, we're talking about the information notice to owner about construction liens at this point. And this document needs to be given at the time a contractor enters into a contract in the amount of $2,000 or more, or $1,000, so $1,000 or more. And it needs to be given out when an oral contract exceeds $1,000. So I might contract for Representative Nelson to put a new deck on her home.
I like that.
Yeah. Be right over. $800.
Yeah.
And while we're in the middle of that, and this happens from time to time, the owner says, you know what, we've got this deck project. How would you like to put on a sauna or maybe a gazebo? Yeah.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, now it's in excess of $1,000. At that point, it's within 5 days after we know it's going to be over $1,000, I'm obligated to provide Representative Nelson with this information notice to owner about construction liens, and the purpose of which is to explain Oregon's, and this is not unique, but it's a tough law for consumers. It puts them at a pay-twice risk. And what we mean by that is that even if the consumer pays the contractor in full, the consumer can end up having to pay sub-suppliers or subs or suppliers again. And the way that happens is they sometimes pay 50% down, the job gets completed, and they pay the other 50% timely, because particularly folks, older folks are used to paying in a timely manner. I think younger folks are too, except for my daughter. In such cases, if a contractor doesn't pay their sub or supplier, the sub or supplier does have a lien right, and you could end up having to pay again. And this is very, very tough for some consumers. We've had some very difficult stories. In one case, a consumer in Yamhill County, very expensive home built, and has suffered as a result of a pay-twice situation by its contractor.
Absolutely. Terrible.
Yeah. And so, we do have a suggestion to fix this otherwise, which is just to remove that possibility of a pay-twice situation. I think that's worth at least talking about. But if you're not going to do that, if the Assembly can't do that, perhaps we can make sure that this document's being handed out. And today, if a contractor doesn't hand this out, they're subject to a lot of penalties. Those penalties include up to a $5,000 fine, and they lose their own lien rights. Their subs and suppliers can still put the consumer at risk, but the general or primary contractor loses its lien right. You'd think that with that much penalty, contractors would give the document out. But it's not happening. We believe that a significant number of contractors aren't giving it out, and so we're looking for a couple of things. We'd like to, this would require that just three different things. If you look under what the bill does, it allows delivery of the document by regular mail, so it changes that a little bit. It requires contractors to keep a signed copy of the form, and requires contractors to produce a copy of that signed document to the CCB within 72 hours if the agency asks for it. And we would ask for it if we believe that a consumer had been put at risk. Failure of a delivery of the document in a timely manner would create a rebuttable presumption that the notice was not provided. And, of course, it's a rebuttable presumption. So the point is that although that presumption may be there, if the contractor can prove it was given out, that's the important issue. Failure to deliver the document in a timely manner would create the presumption. And right now, we probably process a handful of these complaints because consumers don't know that they didn't get it. That's part of the problem. And when we do process it, as I say, we have a problem with proof at hearing, and we often lose those hearings. So we believe this is a reasonable attempt to provide some tools to the agency that will allow us to prove the fact that it wasn't given. And we think that I think it's reasonable expectation on the part of contractors that they keep a signed copy of the document. Happy to answer questions.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like your permission to do two or three questions, a chain of questions, if I may.
As long as you're not using visual aids, that would be fine.
Okay. How many staff does CCB have?
Yeah. Chair Holby, Representative Riley, 60.
And is that enough to process all these claims? And even more importantly, is it enough to know what's going on out in the construction community? Do you know what jobs are being performed? Who has, what's going on out there? Because it seems to me that, you know, if you don't know what's going on out there, then all these things are very necessary and, in fact, won't even work. Okay? But if you know what's going on out in the community, if you require people to let you know when they're going to start a job, then some of this stuff's not necessary, and if it is necessary, then it might start to work.
Right. Chair Holby, Representative Riley, we support the governor's budget, and the governor's budget doesn't have any additional FTE for us this year.
So your answer is that you have enough staff to do all this stuff?
Chair Holby and Representative Riley.
Answer that.
we work the staff hard, and I can tell you that we have about a third of our resources dedicated towards enforcement activities. I think an argument can be made, and we're attempting to have that discussion with the industry, with the Assembly, and others about whether or not our staffing levels are adequate. And, I think you get what you pay for with CCB. I think you get what you pay for with state government, frankly. But it's a discussion between, as you well know, between the citizenry and government as to how much you want to pay for.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I'm impressed by the answer. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, has the Construction Claims Task Force studied the risk involved in the problem of this possibility of customers paying twice for the same construction goods and services? And if so, is the recommendation consistent with this bill?
Good question. Chair Olivey and Representative Bonamici, there is some discussion of this topic. I think you'll find that on the very last page, what a segue, in this packet, which is a page from the task force recommendations, wherein they discuss the notices and provide some recommendations. For the most part, it's parallel. Their approach is just a little bit different than the contractor's board. We may be a little more intimate with this problem than they, and perhaps that explains the differences.
Thank you. Follow-up, please,
follow
Mr. Chair?
Up, please.
Thank you. This is a bit unrelated. In the other bill that we looked at with the consumer notice, it had a place to, for the consumer to sign and almost a tear-off perforated version. Is there a reason why this one is going to be, there's the ability to mail it? It seems like the hand delivery and the right there sign and tear it off is a more real process. And I don't know about you, but I get a lot of mail, and I try to get to it all. But I wonder if you considered having this in the same format as the other notice.
Yes, Chair Holvey and Representative Bonamici, that's a good question. I had noticed the difference. This particular form is one that's been around for a while. It's always had a place to put the name. It may make some absolute sense to try to design this in the same way. Hadn't really thought about it. Thank you.
For my continuing question as to whether this bill pertains to residential and commercial contractors, again, if you could clarify that for me.
Chair Holvey, again, I think I need to beg your pardon for, I got a little confused on the consumer notice and this notice, which happens to others as well. But the point of the matter is this one, for the most part, deals with residential construction and maybe a slight amount of crossover for some forms of I think strip malls we talked about out in the hall. There are some situations where a contractor may be obligated to provide this even when it isn't a residential home improvement. But this suggested statutory change doesn't affect that. And so what I can tell you is that 9 times out of 10, this is only a residential industry application.
I'm not sure if I understood my answer. So for the 1 time out of 10 that it is a commercial contractor, this pay twice scenario seems like it'd be kind of important to really know for sure whether it deals with commercial construction or not.
Yeah. Chair Holvey, I'm not an expert in lien law. I can tell you that there are different laws that have to do with commercial construction, and again, the experts in the room that understand the commercial application better than I. I can tell you that it's consumers that have the pay twice situation more than out there in the commercial area. They're the places where we get the complaints. I've never received a complaint from an owner of a construction of a commercial structure that was in a pay twice situation, and I think that that's because they're more sophisticated consumer, and the lien laws are written such that they don't have this kind of problem.
Performance bonds.
Yeah, performance bonds as well.
Hmm. Okay, performance bonds. Here's my answer. Any other questions for the Construction Contractors Board, Craig Smith or Tom Scar? Seeing none, thank you so much for your presentation on these four bills. I know it was a lengthy discussion from you on this, but I think it provided us with information about these. And just wanted to clarify, did House Bill 2120 also overlap with the task force recommendations?
Chair Holvey, yes. It's, I think, referred to in the task force as a consumer protection document, and it is mentioned there. It requires the suggestion, I believe, was to have those documents signed.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Lane Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lane Barlow. I represent the Russian American Builders Association. I would have been here for your Friday meeting, but my car broke down. And I understand Bill Kostevsky did a pretty good job representing us for you. Listen to that this morning. I'm not going to take an hour and a quarter rebutting what these gentlemen said. Our biggest purpose is to really bring the concerns of our members to government at every level, whether it's a state agency that's attacking one of our members, or whether it's the lawmaking process like we have here. We formed in July. We're very small. We represent mostly small contractors in North Marion County. The concerns of our members, as we've polled them, is the CCB is an agency which really doesn't need to exist. It more or less adds another layer of bureaucracy on a heavily regulated industry. And it's, from what I've heard here, I've heard a lot of anecdotes, and I've heard, the testimony on new laws, which just allows CCB to burrow into areas where they really don't need to be. That's going to raise some hackles, I'm sure. One of the concerns we get from one of our members, particularly, that's dealing with them now in the Portland area, because our members are basically in two groups. You have the Orthodox Russian Americans, which have lived here most of their lives. They're mostly around the Woodburn area. Our members that are in the Portland area, on the other hand, are fairly recent immigrants, and a lot of those are in the contracting trade. They're faced with an aggressive regulatory agency, particularly CCB, which confronts them with large forms that they don't understand and offers no assistance in helping them to understand them. I'm just going to summarize the bills in the interest of time. You've all got better things to do here. There's been good comments on both sides. 2107, for instance, and 2108 are, as we see them, are pretty much burdensome and unnecessary. You're talking about matters, for instance, bankruptcy petitions that are already in the public record, as well as judgments, and which automatically creates liens that are in the circuit court clerk's record. Those are matters of public record. And on top of this, they're saying $5,000 fines because you don't send a piece of paper someplace. That's really unnecessary as we see it. When you go to 2110, a $5,000 fine for not delivering a notice you can't prove that you delivered or they received, it seems to me like we're coming down on they're coming down on the side of a party of a dispute here, whether a notice was provided or not. You're also adding incentive by doubling the statute of limitations to one party that all they got to do is say, well, we didn't get it, so forth. Just one last comment. This whole notice thing can be cured if it was just attached to the permits, which are a necessary part of the process. Puts the burden for the notice on government where it belongs, rather than the contractors. Okay, that's all we have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you for being here, Mr. Barlow.
Thank you.
You just said, I want to be sure I got that right. You said this notice should be a part of the prints?
No.
When you're getting the building permit?
The permit process, yes. Should be attached to the permits.
So what you're saying, this should be handled by the county?
Should be handled by whoever has to do the permits. You can't do the job without a permit. And just staple it to it. End of controversy.
That would save CCB a lot of work, wouldn't it?
Sure would.
Thank you.
for their poor, overworked staff.
That's right.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Barlow.
Thanks for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair.
Next up, Stephen Cafori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori, here representing the Oregon Remodeler Association. I wanted to comment just on 2110 and 2110 right now. We are supportive of the bill and no problem with the bill, except we would like, we think that there ought to be a notice, a requirement here that this be a signed piece of paper. It doesn't say signed anywhere in the bill, and we think that ought to be there. We also think that there ought not to be a requirement to keep these notices where you don't get the work. These are presented at the time of bid, and if the person chooses someone else to do the work, then why should you be burdened with keeping a record of all these notices that you've given to people who didn't choose to hire you? The purpose of having this is for later dispute, and there wouldn't be any later dispute coming up if you didn't get the job in the first place. That's my testimony.
That's it?
Right.
Sure. Sweet. Questions from the committee of Mr. Cafori? I will take note of that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Mr. Varco.
Good afternoon, Chair. Thank you for hearing me. One question, are we addressing all the bills or just a particular one right now?
The hearing is open on all of them, and if you could state your name for the record.
My apologies. My name is Jim Varco. I am here trying to represent consumers in Oregon and also had a national nonprofit, Homeowners Against Efficient Dwellings organization. On 2107, there is some talk about arbitration. I've talked to a lot of homeowners that have had been victims of construction problems, and one of the areas that they've been made a second victim of is the arbitration process, whereby an arbitration clause is built into the contract. The contract says that the builder will select the arbitrator. I think my partner, Renee Haynes, in a letter to the editor of the Oregonian some time ago that was published, put it pretty well when she closed it by saying that the person that may be judging your builder is his golfing buddy. A lot of these arbitration contracts or clauses, as I understand it, have provisions in them that whatever is decided through the arbitration will remain private. It's, you know, you can't talk about it to anybody. And thereby, you know, using that tactic, people like the CCB or any other consumer will be unaware that somebody may be performing poorly, and these folks are just allowed to continue doing it. It's arbitration can be a good thing. It can also be very expensive, and it can be biased. The state of New Jersey conducted an investigation into arbitration. And as I recall, they found that they looked at some 200 cases of home construction arbitration claims, and not a single one was ever found in favor of the homeowner. And that prompted a bit of an overhaul of the New Jersey system. There is some talk about penalties. I believe Representative Riley made some good points about, you know, well, if the penalty is the same either way, why not just keep your mouth shut or something to that effect? So I'm going to suggest perhaps a stiffer penalty might be appropriate if somebody chooses to say, well, I'm just going to consider this the cost of doing business and I'll take my chances. Maybe the cost of doing business should be high enough that it's not worth it. Not worth trying to avoid the system. I'd like to see some provision in here that if a claim is arbitrated, that the arbitrators be required to notify the CCB of the decision.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Riley.
One of the things that you just mentioned was the difference between notifying the CCB and not notifying the penalty. And my understanding is that they have the option of adding up to $5,000 for not notifying. What I think is two things. Number one, it's not enough because your contractor's license is worth a lot more than $5,000. And secondly, they said they weren't going to maybe enforce it for a year or two. Those were the. I just wanted to comment on what you said.
Thank you, and I agree with your concerns. As I mentioned, I'm sorry, Chair Holder.
Go ahead.
An example comes up here in my hometown of Bend here several years ago. There was a large building that had been in the area for almost forever, and a developer had purchased a property and wanted to tear that building down. There was a lot of public uprising against it and, you know, newspaper stories and things about it. And the whole thing was kind of put on hold. And then all of a sudden everybody came in on a Monday morning and the building was demolished. The builder, as I understood it, was fined for having done so without appropriate permits and such. But it's just, okay, the building's gone. What's anybody going to do about it? In other words, it became whatever penalty was assessed to him, they determined it was is worth it to him, just as a part of cost of doing business. With that building gone, he was able to move forward and probably make a few million dollars. I don't know. Hopefully that made some sense.
Representative Nelson, question.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Mr. Rucker, thanks for being here again today. When you had your disaster, did you get a notification like it's been presented here?
I'll have to check my records on my actual builder, but I don't believe so. I've had builders present me contracts that one example of one is I will build a home for the Barcos. That was it.
That's it. Okay. Thanks.
I can pretty safely say that, I'm just going back on memory here, the 20 or so contractors that I've worked with over the last 10 years or so, I've probably only received either more lien notices than the consumer notices, but very, very few consumer notices, maybe one or two.
Thank you.
So we'd like to keep this moving. We have a few others to testify, so if you can move through your other testimony and summarize it, that would be helpful.
Sure. On the CCB notice, I would like to see that to be a document signed by both parties. In other words, there would be two copies of it. One example why that happens, years ago, the home we purchased before our disaster, we filled out all the paperwork the builder presented us. Our realtor took that paperwork to the builder for his signature. He made a bunch of changes to it, signed it, and handed it back. We were stuck. So I'm suggesting that two signatures, you know, each party having a copy of it, of what was signed. I don't like the idea of the perforated thing because what was above the perforation? Same thing with the lien notice. There was a mention about having that notice tied to the permit. My initial reaction is not favorable to that. Often a permit is taken up by one party. There may be a number of contractors involved. In fact, the homeowner may even be the one taking out the permit, oftentimes urged to do so by the builder, as happened in our case. So I think it would be best that each contractor handle that notice themselves. On 2120 liens, I've sent all of you an email describing some of my thoughts on liens. I don't know if any of you had a chance to see that yet. This is an area I think that is seriously harming consumers in Oregon. The idea that somebody that I have no contractual relationship with, may have never even heard of, could force me to write them a big check or even sell my home because somebody I did have a relationship with didn't pay them. I've been told, well, geez, you know, Mr. Barker, the easy way to handle that is to write the check out to both parties. Well, I've done some checking on that, and I found out that if you're a little bit unscrupulous, you can still get that check cashed. And even then, according to the CCB information, if a contractor fails to pay an employee of theirs, that employee can file a lien against my property. Well, writing a, you know, there's just no way that I can think of to address that. My recommendation on that would be that the only the party that could be allowed to put a lien on my property is one that I have a written contract with. Subcontractors, material suppliers, that is that company's problem. They need to address it. Where I think that would help here is, as an example, a contractor is in business, they go bankrupt, they start in again the next day, they go to a material supplier. That material supplier may not have a problem giving them materials, even if they're insolvent, because they know they can go to the homeowner and get paid. In other words, we might foster a better, more business-like group of people here if the subcontractors have to make sure that the general they're working under is a reputable person or business. Likewise with the material suppliers. Thank you. May I answer any questions?
Questions for Mr. Varco? Appears that you've made your points. We've listened, and I thank you very much for your continued testimony on this subject.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Scott Berry and Jessica Adamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. There are a series of questions on this bill or comments about the impacts on the commercial industry and whether it makes sense to include them in these proposals or not. And so with your indulgence, I'll briefly walk through each of these issues and explain AGC's position. On House Bill 2107, the commercial industry and the residential industry are treated differently with respect to which claims can even come to the CCB for dispute resolution. Large commercial projects are specifically kept out of that process, so it's not even an option for a consumer to take it. In our case, these are business owners to take those claims to the CCB and walk through that process. These are, dependent upon the contract, often arbitration, mediation are the preferred option. And in our case, our owners, being sophisticated businesses, generally with their own set of attorneys, often control who the arbiters are, who the mediators are. I mean, it is a very, believe me, level playing ground, sometimes sloped in the owner's favor, sometimes not, but on the whole, balanced and fair, and arbitration mediation decisions are made and people settle those within the confines of the law, and payment or non-payment, there are other judicial remedies, and we believe those are appropriate. In the commercial industry, sometimes we settle, and we settle not because one party is right or one party is not, or we settle because it is easier to get to a settlement is cheaper for all parties involved than it is to admit fault and take it all the way through the court process and fight it out depending on who's right. So there are a series of reasons why we pursue the court process or through a mediation and arbitration process that don't necessarily reflect on the integrity or lack thereof on the part of the business owner. Sometimes they're payment disputes that are legitimate, that are handled in a court of law or pursuant to the contract terms that we have. They aren't necessarily evidence that a contractor is or is not an appropriate contractor to enter in that business relationship with, and we believe that it is inappropriate to have these kinds of decisions reflected at the CCB. It just doesn't mesh with the way that we do business. Perhaps it is appropriate for consumers, given that in a consumer environment, generally you don't involve attorneys in that kind of contract process, but it is a very different thing where in the commercial environment you have written contracts and contract you have a fair dispute over what that contract looks like up front. On House Bill 2108, we are opposed to this bill and very concerned about it, primarily as it relates to the corporate officers and their personal finances. In some of our companies, we may have multiple corporate officers, as large corporations do. Bankruptcy, especially on a personal level, is not, in those cases, necessarily reflective of the business as a whole. You could have someone going through a divorce, somebody doesn't pay the bills, you don't have options, and there are a variety of reasons people go into personal bankruptcy. Perhaps they had a medical emergency and didn't have enough money to cover it, so they declare bankruptcy. There are a variety of reasons people do that. It is allowed under the law, and when you're talking about big companies, and you look at personal filings, again, it is not necessarily reflective on the state of the company, and in fact can be very detrimental to that company that is otherwise doing a great job delivering service in the state if there's a bankruptcy that pops up on the screen but is only related to a person and their personal finances, not related to the corporation itself. We are, again, additionally concerned, though less so, with the corporate reporting, though we understand that this is public record and that it is obtainable. In our case, in the commercial environment, often we are required to obtain bond and heavy insurance for these projects. If we can obtain that bond and insurance, that is the owner's assurance that we will see the project through the end. And in fact, in the public environment, having a bond in place requires significant financial scrutiny, and that's something that owners have access to. And on the commercial side, it's pretty standard. And so we have concerns about that, though we're willing to look at that part. But we think that the personal reporting and the notification required in a personal environment is particularly problematic given the number of corporate officers that we have and the impact that would have on businesses. On House Bill 2110, we do believe that it would be appropriate to clarify that this notice would be for residential contractors on residential projects. As it relates to the permit issue, it seems to us from a consumer protection standpoint that not all projects require permits. For example, replacing a roof or painting the side of a building or doing some interior construction, you don't always have to pull a permit to do that construction. And this notice, it seems like it would be best on a broader basis. Finally, on 2120 and lien law, God bless you for looking into lien law and how all of that works. That is the proverbial tar pit, which anyone in construction has an opinion on lien law, and depending on where you are in the food chain, it's good or bad. For commercial contractors, as it relates to this notice, again, contractual provisions and provisions that are different for commercial projects than residential projects or statute make this notice not necessary on the commercial side. However, that said, in looking at lien law overall, commercial contractors, usually the general contractor, is often in the pay-twice situation. It's not often that you lose a general contractor on a commercial project, but sometimes you lose subcontractors, and we end up picking up the payment twice for their material suppliers or subcontractors. So we feel the pain of owners, and to eliminate the pay-twice piece, we'd say, if the owner's paid, the general contractor's paid, and so on and so forth down the line, that's a topic of great interest to us. We wish you the best in debating that issue. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions?
I have a question.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jessica, for your testimony. With regard to 2108, I doubt that the intent is to get at the kind of situation that you were describing where there's an officer who, for personal reasons unrelated to the business, filed bankruptcy. But I also think that it is intended to get to this, maybe the smaller contractors where it is there is a relationship. Do you have some sense of what that, how we could limit that, maybe by the size of the business, or could there be some sort of exemption for an unrelated personal bankruptcy? I just want to get some ideas on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, off the top of my head, I'm not sure that I can come up with an answer right here, but AGC is more than happy to work with the CCB and yourself and Mr. Berry to find something that might work in this case. We also believe that this was perhaps not the intention of the CCB to incorporate where you have many corporate officers and an unrelated financial issue. Unfortunately, we're looking at the bill as it is and want to go on the record as raising that concern.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Jessica. Scott? State your name for the record. You're used to that.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And first off, I'd like to say, in general, I think we're pretty positive about the legislation that's in front of us today, in front of you today, and that we've gone through. There are some technical things that we would like to see addressed before we would be able to support. One of them was already brought up by Mr. Kaforia, and that was, is there a penalty for the contractor whose bid was not accepted? And then another piece on one of the other piece of legislation was how long does the contractor have to hold that information? 2 years, which I think should be maybe the number out there, is not in the bill. That would allow for the longest time that the consumer would have to file a claim, even under current proposals, to be met before that document could be destroyed. So that would be something we'd hope would be taken care of. And then in addition to that, we share some of the concerns on 2108. But again, I think from our point of view, we'd like to see a small group of us get together and kind of work with the contractors board to iron out some of the concerns, technical concerns we have that often can come out of legislative council when something an idea goes in and comes out in specific form. That's when you really need to get down to the details and make sure it all works for everyone involved. Finally, on the pay twice, it's an issue that actually came up with Lien Law a couple of sessions ago, and at that time, Representative Merkley, now Speaker Merkley, worked with us to find a solution, and that solution addressed new homes and remodels over $50,000, and it provided that one of, I believe, five or six solutions had to be provided by the contractor so that the consumer was not stuck holding the bag after the general contractor was paid. And today that is current law. The most common of those, actually, is that the consumer is simply allowed the same title insurance that the banks were always getting. And in other words, the banks were never held having to pay twice. They had protection through title insurance and through an insurance policy. That was now extended. One of the options was to allow for that to be extended to consumer. For almost all of our builders, the title companies now provide that to the builder as an additional policy that's handed over to the consumer. And if there is a scenario under which that business goes out, the construction company goes out of business, then the title insurance or the insurance provided by the title company actually picks up those unpaid liens. So, and it's a very small window. I should also mention it only is in effect for 75 days after the last contractor, subcontractor, works on the job site. That's the amount of time that sub has to perfect that lien. Once that 75 days is gone, no other lien could be perfected, and there isn't anything left for the consumer to have to pay. So it's just in those instances where you might finish the home, and 40 days later it's purchased, and then you would have 35 days where there could be a lien perfected, and regular title insurance may not pick it up. So it was a very rare instance, but had happened. And we believe that's been taken care of again. New construction and remodels over $50,000.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you so much for your testimony, and I'm sure the CCB would like your input on your concerns with these bills. So I encourage you to let them know what they are, and we'll take another look at these later, perhaps.
Thank you.
Oh, we have one other person signed up for testimony. I almost skipped. Ralph Groener.
Well, you should have skipped him.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I have my hearing aids on for the first time, and I want you to know I'm hearing my voice come out, and I feel a little weird, but for the record, my name is Ralph Groener. You had the Russian-American group. I'm here on behalf of American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We support the latter two bills. You can amend them, but 2110 and 2120. But just a comment, I wasn't really ready to testify yet because ask me, with almost 1.5 million members nationally and over 30,000 in Oregon and growing, is trying to change how the union approaches things. I may as well be right up front with all of you. And that is, we frankly feel the public deserves to understand that unions aren't just there for themselves, but in fact, my agencies, and I've just listed them in my mind, I rep all of those. Mary has public safety, but I have all the construction boards from CCB to building codes to real estate, then over to DEQ, all fee-based. Very little general fund, DEQ very small. The remainder are fee-based. Just an overall comment, it's been my observation over the last 30 years around the legislature, that where we are fee-based, there are problems not only for the person, the home builder, et cetera, but for the consumer. I want to start with a little bit of a story about what happened to me. I was very naive. I hired my best friend many years ago to remodel my little house I bought, and I hired a best friend, knew nothing about CCB, knew nothing about codes, knew nothing about anything other than he was my best friend, and this is what I wanted. Well, the result of that, at my mistake, was $100,000 I ended up paying because it failed to do anything to protect my house, and water got in and carpenter ants. It doesn't matter. Termites in the insurance industry said you're too late. And I had no idea I had a problem. And so I ended up paying not only my first mortgage, but that off. And I finally got involved with these issues and have learned that, and from my point of view, codes and CCB are certainly things I wish I had known about when I remodeled. And that took a lot of money out of my pocket. That's one of the ways, and I'll be working here. For many, many years, longer than the normal retirement age, because I lost a significant amount of money to a remodel. I'm not sad about having to be here. I love this particular line of work because I fight. So let me comment. The bills that we support, were you're hitting us right between the eyes quickly. Ask me with its new model. We'll be coming in with a consumer protection, and thank you all very much for having a consumer committee and government efficiency. There'll be over 12, 13 bills. Two of them are here that we support in behalf of the consumers of Oregon from different agencies, not just CCB. Also, there are some government efficiencies coming through Building Codes Division that will help the home builders and the people I serve on CPAC, Construction Industry Policy Advisory Council. I've learned a lot from my colleagues. I knew nothing. I still am here. They're here. But I've learned a lot. And the one thing I have learned is the Oregonian did a series on this, and I hope you all read it. There were some unfair charges against CCB, but the point was people had problems. I hope you all read it. Front page went on and on and on, and they're waiting. This is a big committee. This is a big issue. And people were concerned, so now you had the task force. They did a wonderful job. They worked. They met. They considered you're going to have a good number of those issues. Where AFSCME's coming down is we're going to enter the fray without being antagonistic, but rather, frankly, not so much in behalf of my members, but the consumer. My agencies represent the consumer. How many taxpayers or fee members realize that my state employees, right from my investigators of real estate, to my investigators at Construction Contractors Board, to my my building codes permits, be it electrical, plumbing, etc., are there for the protection of the public. And I heard the Russian-American person say that we shouldn't have any. I'm one who says you not only should have, but we need to improve it, and that's what you're talking about today. I'm so ecstatic that we even have a consumer protection. When I was a young man, well, you're all younger than I was, starting here in 73, we had a consumer protection organization in Oregon. Don Wilner was a lawyer, and boy, they were here on top of consumer protection issues every day. We've had this void for years, and thank you for coming along, because the fact is you asked a question about staffing. Sorry to relay that now. The truth is, from if you observe, and that's what Ways and Means, I realize that, if you look at the staffing pattern, we don't always think contracting out to the private sector works, and our agency will, if you want to listen to it, to make require my members to come in front of management and find out what happened. Find out what happened when they privatized and went outside, lost control, and now we're looking at, and management, I understand, concurs that those jobs should be back where they belong on behalf of the consumer, where there's some control for the public good. When I looked at the chart on the wall, I was trying to figure out why the Oregonian was so in those articles. It was really heavy. Television, radio, this is the issue. It's a big one of this session. What happened? I went into my office and asked staff, show me how many work in Portland Metro to go out and do investigations. Over 1 million people, Portland Metro. If I recall, I don't want to give you false numbers, two. So somebody has to ask, and that'll be Ways and Means, can two people handle the problems that came up in the Oregonian? And you just stated, by the way, thank you, Representative Riley, the fact of the matter is they couldn't. They just couldn't do it. So it's not that you don't need a public agency. I don't want to be on the other end of the spectrum. I guess I am. And that is, frankly, you need highly trained people to do the job. They do the job that you're proud of as a committee. But they're there to make sure not that a state employee is proud of themselves, but they'd be proud of themselves that they're making sure that the public is getting the best possible representation they can. And so we believe 2110 and 2120, you can amend those, are a start. We will have other bills we will be testifying to under the AFSCME's Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Initiative, which is being prepared right now. You went ahead of us. Thank you. So we will be presenting that to all 90 legislators, and we certainly would like you to remember that what this thing is really about is what the name of your committee is, and that's the consumer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm not going to allow any questions because we're past due our time. I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2107, 2108, 2110, and 2120, and I adjourn House Committee on Consumer Protection.